potential threat from nanotechnology is so severe that it's worth the loss of Moonbase to be safe from it. For a long moment, the two women sat facing each other in plush armchairs set before the Oval Office's dark and empty fireplace. Bonai wore a sleeveless sheath of pink, with pearls at her throat, earlobes, and wrist. The president was in a navy blue suit, with a modest mid-calf skirt and jewelry of silver and turquoise from her native Arizona. "Are you aware," Bonai asked slowly, "that the United Nations intends to turn over the operation of Moonbase to Yamagata Industries once they have taken the base?" The president glanced at her aide, sitting quietly across the room behind Bonai's back, with a cyberbook-sized computer in the palm of one hand. The young man had a miniaturized microphone clipped to the inside of his shirt collar, so he could sub-vocalize information to the all-but-invisible receiver in the president's left ear. "Yamagata Industries," she said, stalling for time. "They already have a base on the moon, don't they?"
"Yes," said Bonai.
"And they intend to take over Moonbase and continue using nanomachines for many purposes, including manufacturing clipper ships." "Are you certain?" The president was now glaring at her aide, who had given up all pretense of secrecy and was scrolling madly through his computer files. "That would give Yamagata, Japan really, the world leadership in aerospace transportation," Bonai said. The aide shook his head and whispered. The president put on a smile and parroted, "I have had no indication from Mr. Foray that the UN intends to turn Moonbase over to Yamagata."
"Then may I suggest," Bonai said, "with all respect, that you ask Mr. Foray directly if he plans to do this."
The president's brows knit slightly. "May I ask what your interest is in all of this? After all, Moonbase is trying to break away from Kiribati's ownership, aren't they?"
"Kiribati supports Moonbase's independence. It will have no effect on our business relationship with Moonbase. We intend to formally recognize Moonbase's independence."
"Is that so?" The president leaned slightly toward Bonai and made a motherly smile. "Let me give you a bit of friendly advice, young lady. Kiribati's recognition of Moonbase won't affect the political situation one iota. So don't stick your neck out. You might regret it later on."
Bonai smiled back thinly. "I appreciate your frankness, Madam President, but I do think that America's recognition of Moonbase's independence would be in keeping with the finest traditions of your nation."
The president sighed, her signal to her aide to end the meeting. He immediately got to his feet and walked across the Oval Office to bend over her and say, "I'm afraid the ambassador from Uganda has been kept waiting for more than 3 minutes now." Bonai took the hint, got to her feet, and left the Oval Office. Now she leaned back on the limousine's fine leather seat, resting her head on the backrest as the car inched through the traffic on its way to her hotel. Rashid was either too polite or too crafty to ask her how the meeting had gone. "I've arranged for dinner in the hotel's restaurant," he said, rubbing his hands together. "It's quite a lovely place, very quiet and private. The food is excellent." Bonai said, "That's fine." And she realized that Rashid hadn't expected anything of significance to come out of her 5 minutes in the Oval Office. His whole attention was focused on their evening together. Jack Killifer had just enough time to down a premixed martini on the commercial flight between Washington and Boston. He had followed Bonai to Washington and immediately given up any hope of killing her there. Too many guards, too many police, too many people on the streets and in the hotels. "I'm no professional hitman," he grumbled to himself on the brief flight home. "Why'd O'Connor pick me for the job?" He knew perfectly well. Killifer had brought Bonai's intransigence to General O'Connor's attention, and O'Connor had always been a firm believer in the idea that the man with the problem should be the man to produce the solution. But murder? Maybe when she's all alone out on that little island of hers. Or even in the town on Tarawa Atoll. The only real security those islanders have is guards for the casino. As the plane lowered its landing gear and lined up for landing at Boston's ancient Logan Aerospace Port, Killifer toyed with the idea of calling O'Connor in Atlanta and asking for a professional to do the work, or even one of the faithful Urban Corps fanatics. But it'd be a waste of breath, he knew. O'Connor had made it clear. He wanted Killifer to do this job personally. The fewer people know about this, the general had said, the better off we are. Yeah, Killifer told himself as the plane's tires screeched on the runway. And knocking off Bonai'll give him an absolute grip on me. Yet he was almost smiling as he got out of his seat and followed the other passengers to the plane's exit hatch. Okay, he told himself. When Bonai goes back to Tarawa, I go back too. I'll hit her there. Now that I know the layout of the islands, it ought to be fairly easy. And he began to lay his plans. Day 38. They watched the clipper ship settle down gracefully on landing pad 1 from the snug confines of her quarters. Well, said Nick O'Malley, there she is. Claire Rossi nodded. Aren't you excited? He asked, forcing a grin. Sitting on the edge of the bed, Claire said,
About the wedding?
Yes.
About leaving? No.
Well, you've got to go, Nick said. It's for your own good and the baby's. Claire nodded again. But she said,
It's not an illness, you know. Pregnancy is just as normal as breathing, really.
The rules are the rules, Nick insisted. Besides, you'll get better medical care back Earthside, and your mother'll be there with you.
But you won't. I'll come down on the next flight. Nick, there might not be a next flight.
Now look. The phone chimed, and Claire immediately called out,
Answer!
Ginny Anson's chipper face appeared on the wall. Okay, you two. We're down to 2 hours and counting. Claire said,
We'll be there.
With bells on, Nick added. They forgot their argument and began dressing for the wedding. Claire had borrowed liberally from her friends and put together a beige long-skirted dress, the closest she could find at Moonbase to a wedding gown, and various accessories that almost looked right. Nick could find nothing that fit his big frame except a fresh pair of white coveralls from the medical stores. The wedding was held in Ginny Anson's office, with half a dozen of their friends in attendance, and Claire's arms filled with a bouquet of flowers freshly plucked from Lev Brudnoy's little garden. The Archbishop of Kiribati, brown skin and flashing white teeth, looked out at them from the wall screen. Dressed in the full regalia of purple stole and skullcap, he appeared to be in a chapel made of stuccoed walls and a timbered roof. Anson, Doug, and Harry Clemens stood off to one side while Edith, camera glued to one eye, panned across the office. Joanna and Lev Brudnoy watched from the wall screen on the other side of the room. The ceremony was brief, a little awkward with the transmission delay, yet somehow touching. Doug heard Anson sniffle slightly beside him. Looking over to the far wall, he thought that his mother looked just a bit teary-eyed, too. Why do women cry at weddings? He wondered. When he finished, the Archbishop grinned at them and said in a strong voice, There will be no collection. The Catholics in the small crowd laughed. The married couple and their friends trooped out of Anson's office on their way to a reception in the cave. Some honeymoon they're going to have, Anson said, sounding a little wistful. The clipper ship lifts off tomorrow at 10:00 hours. Well, at least they were able to get married, Clemens said. I hope that makes them happy. Doug had already turned his attention to his mother's image on the wall screen. Any progress with Foray? He asked. After 3 seconds, she shook her head gravely.
He's making the maximum media noise about this so-called mercy flight. Otherwise, he's stonewalling me.
Any indications of preparations by the peacekeepers? Doug asked, standing before his mother's larger-than-life image. Brudnoy, standing slightly behind her, answered,
No indications at all. They seem to be doing nothing at present. Of course, they could be getting ready for another assault in secrecy.
That's what I'd do, I suppose, Doug agreed. No sense letting your enemy see you coming.
The board meeting is tomorrow, Joanna said. I've got to turn Rashid around and get him to support you.
Tamara Bonai got no place with the president, Doug muttered. Once she heard his words, Joanna raised a finger.
Don't be too sure of that. The ambassador to Japan just flew back unexpectedly to Washington on a clipper ship. Something's stirring, I think.
Doug thought about that for a moment, then said, Mom, this may be off the wall, but have you considered talking directly to Yamagata? The delay was much more than 3 seconds this time.
You mean the old man himself, Seigo Yamagata?
If he'll see you. Her expression hardened.